Would she tell Meg? It had been worded as a friendly warning, not a threat. How much had she actually heard, anyway? Beth couldn't remember what they'd said. She knew she'd been whispering. But Bill was incapable of whispering. What had he said? She flinched as she remembered that he'd used the words, in the act. If she stopped now, right now, it would be almost as if it had never happened. They'd only been doing this affair thing for a couple of months. She'd only had sex with him a handful of times. If they could stop it now, grow a thick layer of skin over the memory of it, there was no paper trail, no physical evidence. They could pretend it never happened. No one would get hurt. But she already knew she couldn't do that. She couldn't stop now. After all, they'd only just begun. Chapter 6. Wednesday, 1st of December, 2010. Dear Jim, oh, gosh, I have to tell you that I have not thought about Christmas at all. No, I would say that I tend to float rather aimlessly through the days and months these days, like a child's lost balloon towards the horizon, never to be seen again. My children all live too far away. And of course, I could go and stay with them, but I think I've mentioned before my rather silly fear of spending a night away from home. The last time I slept in a bed that was not mine was at the hospice, in the closing days and nights of my partner's life. Before that, it was the night after the twins were born. And before that, it was... God! Before any of the children were born, I suppose. So, yes, I am rather stuck here now. And happily so. My parents, as I mentioned, are long gone. My sister lives in Corfu. So that's it. I'm Norma Nomates. Having said that, my partner's children still live locally. The youngest in particular is quite fond of me, so I may receive an invitation yet. But frankly, Jim, I really don't care much either way. It's just another day to me now. They all are. I hope that doesn't make me sound like an awful old misery bags. I'm really not. Honestly, considering some of the things I've lived through, considering my circumstances, I'm really rather a jolly person. And what about you? How will you spend Christmas Day? Do you have any family locally? Any friends? Or maybe you'll have lunch at your pub. I must say I do like the sound of your pub. I feel I've made a mistake in my life not finding myself a nice local watering hole, somewhere cosy to go to and see friends and have a glass of wine, get me out of the house every day. But I think that boat has sailed. The pubs round here these days are all ghastly gastro pubs now, all posh Londoners and their loud conversations and silly great cars. And half the time there isn't anywhere to sit and have a drink, if a drink's what you want. Anyway, I should get out more. That's beyond question. But the older I get, the more time passes, the less I feel like there's anything for me out there. Feels like it all belongs to other people, you know. The grubby little face at the window of the smart restaurant. That's how it appears to me. And here, in my home with my things, I'm the queen. In my palace. I belong. Ah. Anyway, I guess at our age, we're all a bit odd, aren't we? How's your dog's leg, by the way? I do hope she's recovering well from the operation. All best love. Laurie. Kiss, kiss, kiss. April 2011. How come you've got signal in here? Said Molly, waving her phone around, pointing it towards the window. No idea, said Meg. Let's go, shall we? Let's go and check into the hotel. Oh, yes, please. The hotel had been half the lure to get Molly up here. She hated skiing and had been angling to stay in London with her best friend Georgia instead. Meg had not been happy about the prospect of worrying about her teenage daughter for 14 days and 14 nights, and had been playing mental tug-of-war with herself over whether or not Molly was ready to be left. Then they'd had the phone call about Lorelei, and Bill had said he'd take the boys skiing on his own, and Molly had said, I'm not sure, when Meg had asked her if she'd come with her. So Meg had found the cutest, plushest, bijouist little boutique hotel on the Mr. and Mrs. Smith website and said, Look, I'll be staying here. Are you sure you don't want to come? And Molly had said, Cool. Yes, I'll come with you. Molly had always loved, what she used to call when she was small, fancy hotels. When she was 8, she'd had it all decided that she would be a hotelier when she grew up. She would draw intricate sketches of her hotel. There would be real palm trees in the bedrooms, and buttons you pressed to get champagne out of the walls, and a menu for choosing the exact colour of bath towel you required. Nowadays, her ambitions lay in something to do with television, maybe producing or directing or something, you know. The journey back through the house, like all return journeys, felt shorter and less convoluted. The sense of knowing how long the tunnels were and where they ended up was reassuring, and for a moment Meg could almost feel the security that her mother would have felt, passing about here in the warm corridors of her self-created warren. Meg locked the back door behind them and tucked the key into her pocket. She regarded the door pensively for a moment, and then turned to greet the outdoors. This sweet expanse of space, with its smell of air and its noises of traffic and everything being as it should be. Molly waved her phone about again and said, Still no signal. I'm sure you'll pick one up once we're on the road. Meg was quite glad there was no signal. With a signal, Molly would be lost to her. The car would be filled with the teeth-achingly irritating noise of not-that-bright teenage girls talking rubbish to each other, or the sound of text messages pinging back and forth every 10 seconds. Without a signal, they could sit, side by side, appreciate the scenery, and maybe even talk. Meg started the engine, and Molly stared at the house through her Ray-Bans. So weird, she said. Just to think, you lived there. All of you. You were all just, like, normal kids, going to school and stuff, having friends, and then one by one you all left her, and she died, you know, completely alone in, like, the worst house in Britain or whatever. She shook her head solemnly. Weird, she said again. I mean, can you imagine that happening to us? Like, seriously? All four of us just leaving you there and falling out with each other and Dad going off with some crazy woman and you just going completely mental and not letting anyone in and building, like, tunnels out of, like, newspapers? Think of our house. Our lovely house with all its lovely things in it. And, yeah, okay, it's a bit too tidy for my liking, but, you know, it's a really nice house and we all live there and we're so happy and everything. And when I'm an adult, I want to see my brothers all the time, you know. I want to go to their houses and stuff and have my kids play with their kids. I mean, you haven't seen your brother and sister for, like, 5 years. Your actual brother and sister, who you used to live with and see every day. I mean, I just don't get it. How can things go, like, she turned to stare at Meg with wide blue eyes, so wrong? Meg flicked on her indicator and glanced in the wing mirror, her hands balanced on the steering wheel. Sometimes, darling, she began, pulling the people carrier out into the road, I simply do not have an answer. April 2000. Meg squirted sun cream onto her fingertips and slicked it over the limbs, shoulders, noses and knees of the 3 small children lined up before her by the pool. Molly received the application of sun cream as if it were an expensive spa treatment. She stood straight and solid, fingers splayed out, eyes closed, turning on command. Alfie received it more like a spiteful punishment, wriggling and grimacing and wailing, "Why, Mummy, why?" Stanley, the baby, walking already at 10 months, that had not been the plan when they'd booked this holiday 6 months ago. He was supposed to have been a baby still, portable and immobile, not this toy-sized human running about in proper leather shoes. Took it more as a game, smiling coquettishly at his mother as he tried to avoid her touch. 3 children down the line, a 4-year-old, a just 3-year-old, a very nearly 1-year-old. Meg was military when it came to this kind of thing. Bill, the self-appointed civilian, lay across from them prone on a lounger, holding a paperback spread wide open above his face to keep out the fierce rays of the Greek sun. "Need any help?" he said, at the precise moment that she had screwed the lid back onto the tube of sun cream. She smiled bittersweetly at him and said, "No, darling, I'm fine. You just relax." He knew she was being facetious, but he also knew that if he wanted to be able to carry on lying there reading a book, he should not acknowledge this.
"Can I swim now?" asked Molly.
"No, darling," said Meg. "You have to wait for the cream to absorb." Molly tutted and rolled her eyes.
"How long will that take?"
Meg smiled wearily. "About 10 minutes." Molly tutted and rolled her eyes again. Meg crouched by the side of the pool and dunked Alfie and Stanley's inflated armbands into the water. Then she squashed them up their arms. "Right," she said. "Let's all have an ice cream. By the time you've eaten the ice cream, it'll be okay to go in the pool, okay?" They all nodded. 3 small heads, the pale brown curls of her daughter and the amber-red helmets of her sons.
"Can I have some money?"
she turned to ask Bill.
"Hmm?"
He looked up at her from his paperback as though he'd just that minute remembered she was there.
"Some money? I need some money for ice creams."
"Oh, yes, sure. In my shorts pocket over there."
She pulled a handful of coins from the warm depths of Bill's empty shorts and took the children to the kiosk on the other side of the resort pool.
"Can you get me an espresso?"
Meg gazed at him in awe. They needed to work on this, she mused. They needed to acknowledge the fact that they had 3 children, that there was not a network of fairies and elves fluttering around behind the scenes getting everything done as Bill appeared to believe there was, and work out some kind of timetable. Some kind of schedule so that Meg could maybe, just maybe, read a book too. The choosing of ice creams turned them briefly into a small circus. Molly couldn't decide, and became very cross with Meg about it. Alfie decided too soon, and changed his mind the moment Meg had pulled the wrapper off, and Stanley dropped his on the floor and screamed. A woman appeared behind them in the queue, a serene creature in a white dress, tailed by 2 immaculate sylph-like daughters, all blonde, all legs. Meg glanced briefly at them, then at her raggle-taggle mismatch of screaming infants. Molly in last year's chlorine-stained swimsuit because they hadn't started selling swimwear in the shops yet. The boys in cheap blue things from Woolworths. Freckled backs and chocolate-smeared faces. She thought of herself. A size 14 to 16 now. 14 to 16! And all on her hips and thighs, not an extra ounce on her boobs. She thought of her unwaxed bikini line. She simply had not had the time. She'd had to shave instead and given herself a rash. Her sensible swimsuit, her latest, not entirely successful, haircut. She'd had the baby on her lap and hadn't been concentrating on what the hairdresser was saying. It was very short. She thought of the past 5 sleepless nights, all squashed into what had laughably been described as a family suite, but was in fact a normal hotel room with a travel cot and 2 camp beds packed into it. And then she smiled tightly at the mother behind her and said, "Sorry about this travelling circus, we'll be out of your way any minute." The blonde mother, with her feline features and long hair and finely turned ankles, smiled and said, "Don't worry, it's fine. We've all been there." And Meg laughed dryly and thought, "No, we haven't. Or, if we have, some of us have taken a very different route through it." She collected Stanley into her arms and helped him hold his replacement ice cream. He was slick with sun cream, and she almost lost him through the space between her arms. But somehow she managed to keep hold of both him and his ice cream, and she carried them and Bill's fucking espresso back past the pool, past the sun loungers full of people lying down, reading books and sipping cocktails, and, more gallingly than anything, sleeping. Bastards. She landed in an ungainly way on her sun lounger. The combined weight of herself and her hefty infant almost folding the thing up in half. Molly had finally settled, much to Meg's distaste, but really, if there was one thing that Meg had learned about dealing with children, it was how to pick your battles, upon a lurid green thing in a paper tube that she did not know how to operate.
"Mummy," she whined. "I can't open it. Mummy."
Meg dropped the tiny cup of espresso loudly and pointedly on the table between their loungers and snatched the thing from Molly's hand, hissing, "For God's sake, give it to me." Bill looked at her reproachfully. "What?" she snapped. He put down his paperback, finally, and stared at Meg as though appalled by her. "Come on," he beseeched. "We're supposed to be on holiday. Can't you just relax a little?" He said this in his "nice Bill" voice, the voice he used to remind her that he, at least, was still the good guy he used to be, even if she was no longer the lovely girl. "No," she said quietly. "I can't relax. How can I?" Bill looked at the three children, now arranged quietly and happily in a row before him, eating their ice creams. "Just enjoy them," he said. "They won't be little for long." "Hands up, who's having the best holiday ever?" All three put their hands in the air. Then Molly put hers down and said,
"Actually, this isn't the best holiday ever."
"Really?" said Bill. "Right. So which holiday was?"
"The one we haven't had yet," she replied, looking pleased with herself for saying something unexpected.
Bill and Meg looked at each other over their children and laughed.
"Oh, yes," said Bill. "I like your attitude, Molly Moo. I like your attitude very much."
He stroked her hair and picked up his espresso. He smiled at Meg.
"I love you," he said pointedly.
Meg smiled back. "I love you too."
"Come on, then."
He jumped to his feet, showing off his nearing middle-aged but still passably fit body in baggy surfer shorts. Having children had closed the age gap between them. These days, Meg often felt as though she was the older one. 29, going on 39.
"Who's coming for a swim?"
They followed him excitedly, jumping up and down, squealing. He took the boys by a hand each and bounced them as they walked, their tiny, weightless bodies fluttering at his sides. They disappeared behind a palm tree and then reappeared at the shallow end. Meg watched them keenly, enjoying them from a distance, a little bit worried that Bill would get distracted by the boys and let Molly drown, but swollen with pride for them all. How could she have felt that flicker of shame just now at the ice cream kiosk? "Look at them," she thought. "Look at my lovely babies. Look at my handsome man." She saw the elegant blonde with the slender pre-teens. She was rubbing cream into the younger one's back. There was no man. Single mum. Doing it all by herself. No one to share a carafe of wine with on the balcony after the children were asleep. Meg smiled. She was feeling better by the minute. She heard Bill's phone vibrating and traced the noise to the other pocket of his empty shorts. She pulled out the phone and saw the name Beth. She smiled,
Her baby sister. And then she frowned. Why was she calling Bill's phone?
Hello?
Oh, hi, Meg. It's me.
Yes, I know it's you. Your name comes up on Bill's phone.
Oh, said Beth. That's useful. I was calling to speak to you, actually.
Oh, right. How come you didn't call my phone, then?
Oh, Bill said to use his. He'd got a better rate on international calls or something.
He told you that?
When? The other day. I called you at home. When you were out.
Did you?
Yes. Anyway, how are you?
Meg passed the phone to her other ear and narrowed her eyes across the pool. Bill was plunging the baby under the water and then bringing him back up again. Stanley was thoroughly enjoying himself, but Meg could hardly bear to watch.
We're fine, thank you.
Having a lovely time.
How's the weather?
Scorchio.
The kids?
Having the time of their lives.
Good.
Meg could hear a hint of sadness in her sister's voice.
That's good.
So?
Oh, yes, I was just calling because it's Easter Sunday.
Oh, shit, really, is it? Meg felt her stomach turn with anger at herself. She had forgotten. For the first time in 9 years, she had forgotten the anniversary of her brother's death. Oh, Christ, yes, of course it is. It's just, you know, out here, you kind of forget what day of the week it is.
Yes, I know. It's easy to do.
It's no excuse. I'm cross with myself. I'm as bad as Mum.
Oh, don't be stupid. Of course you're not, and it's fine. You remembered now.
Only because you reminded me. Are you going to the grave?
Yes, said Beth. Me, Dad and Vicky are going later, after lunch.
Mum?
No.
She pulled out the vowel in the word to express the inevitability.
She says she's going to think about him instead.
Meg sighed. It was barely worth talking about anymore. Anyone coming over today?
No, said Beth. Just us. Dad. The girls.
She sighed.
I wish you were going to be here.
Yes. Well, I was going to say me too, but really, how overdue is this Greek holiday? She laughed, and Beth laughed too.
I know, she said. It's so weird here now. Everything's so different. I hate it here sometimes, I really do.
Meg took a deep breath. She could hear tears in her sister's voice. She could also see Molly running towards her, looking aggrieved about something.
Mummy, Alfie pushed me and Daddy said it wasn't his fault and it was his fault and he did it on purpose and everyone always thinks everything is my fault!
Meg nestled the phone between her shoulder and her ear and opened her arms to her firstborn.
I'm going to be 28 this year. I haven't got a boyfriend. I haven't got a flat. I haven't even got a best friend. I feel such a failure.
Oh, that's ridiculous, Beth. Come on. You're the best PA in the county.
You're beautiful. Look, Mummy, look. I've got a hurt where Alfie pushed me. Look, I need a plaster.
She kissed the hurt absent-mindedly and squeezed Molly to her and moved the phone once again to the other ear.
Well, yes, but don't you think at nearly 30 there should be more to life than being a good secretary and being pretty? I just feel so trapped, Meggie. I feel like Gulliver tied down all over with tiny little ropes, like they're all so tiny, but there's so many of them that I can't move. Do you know what I mean? And most of them are in my own head because,
come in the pool, Mummy. Please come in the pool with me. I don't want to be in the pool with Daddy. I don't like Daddy. I like you. Please, Mummy, please.
Really, there is no reason why I couldn't have been like you, is there? Why I couldn't have moved out, got married, done something with my life.
Please, Mummy, please, Mummy, please, Mummy, now. Mummy, now, Mummy.
Okay, she shouted. Okay!
What?
Not you, Beth. Not you. Molly. She wants me to take her into the pool. Sorry.
Beth sighed.
Don't be sorry. It's my fault. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be bugging you on your holiday. I shouldn't be loading you down with all my stupid problems.
I'll call you back, she said, in a few minutes.
Okay?
No, said Beth. You don't need to.
Really. I'll be fine.
It's just, you know, Easter, getting older. I'm probably just having a, what is it they call it? A quarter-life crisis.
Well, yes, said Meg.
Maybe you are. And that might not be such a bad thing. You know, I want more for you than this, too. I do. You're better than this. I'll call you back. 5 minutes, okay?
She took Molly to the pool and chased her up and down a few times, made her giggle, made her smile, and then headed back to the sun lounger without a towel, dripping water all over Bill's paperback. She picked up Bill's phone and switched it on. She found Beth's number in his phone book and pressed call. But instead of dialing Beth's number, it brought up a call history. Meg squinted at it.
Odd, she thought. How odd?
Lots of calls, both to and from Beth's phone. She stared at the screen for several minutes. The calls between the two numbers went back almost to the day Bill had bought his new phone, 3 months earlier. There were long gaps between the calls, but when they came, they were 3 or 4 a day. She tried to apply sensible theories to the matter of the call history. Another Beth? Unable to get through to Meg? An affair? She laughed at the thought. And then she smiled. Of course. It was obvious. It was Meg's 30th birthday next month. They were planning a surprise party for her, discussing gifts. She redialed Beth's number, but Beth didn't reply. Beth stared at the phone on her bed. Bill, it flashed. Bill. Taunting her. She could not believe that she had called him. During his holiday. An idiotic thing to do. But still. 2 whole weeks. How on earth could he expect her to go 2 whole weeks without hearing his voice? The phone call had been agonizing. All she could hear were the sounds of the life she wanted. Children keening with joy, the splash of a pool, the sound of distant waves caressing distant sand, the sound of foreign, of other lives being lived by other people. Rory in Spain, Meg and Bill in Greece, and Beth still here. Unpaid nanny, aging secretary, companion to 2 eccentric middle-aged women, last vestige of family to a lonely old father, festering and bitter. She picked up the phone and put it under her pillow. She'd handled the call quite well, she thought. And it was true, Bill had said to use his phone if she needed to call while they were away. So she hadn't even really been lying. Lying to her sister. She disgusted herself sometimes. She really did. But Bill, he was all that lay between her and weirdness. Without Bill, without his approval, and she really did have to assume that he approved of her to take the risk with his future happiness that he did every time he spent time with her, she could not stomach herself. She would take an overdose. Or slit her wrists. Or, God rest his beautiful little soul, hang herself from the beams in Reese's room. Because as long as Bill wanted her, then there was a chance, a tiny infinitesimal chance, that maybe she was normal. From below, up the stairs, around the dog leg and through her bedroom door, came the smell of lamb and rosemary. She heard someone pull a cork out of a bottle of wine. She sighed. Here we go again. And then she thought to herself, this time next year, I will either be dead or I will be somewhere else. Rory mopped the sweat from his hairline and pushed open the door of the bar. He greeted Ramon the bartender in Spanish and headed for the phone at the back of the room.
No está funcionando, said Ramon.
What? Said Rory. You're kidding me. He kicked the base of the counter with his right foot. He'd promised his mum he'd call her today. She said she'd be waiting for his call. It was a long walk from the farm to Ramon's bar, and at just after midday in nearly 30 degrees, he hadn't enjoyed one moment of it.
¿Una cerveza?
Rory shrugged and nodded, and Ramon poured him a small beer. Rory downed it in one. In this heat, beer sometimes felt like a vital nutrient.
Gracias, he said wearily.
De nada. Feliz Pascua.
Yeah, said Rory. Feliz Pascua.
He passed his empty beer glass to the bartender, and then he walked all the way back to the farm again. Kaylee was sitting on the front step of their lodge. The baby was on her breast, half covered with a sheet of muslin.
Shh!
Kaylee put her finger to her mouth and frowned. Then she mouthed the word,
sleepin'.
Rory smiled.
Good, he thought.
He pointed to the left and mouthed,
Owen.
And then he mimed smoking a big spliff, and Kaylee tutted and rolled her eyes at him. Owen had arrived on the farm 3 weeks ago. He was a builder and scaffolder from Essex. Until a month ago, he'd been married to a model, lived in a big, shiny house with two cars and a selection of pedigree dogs. Then he'd woken up one morning and decided that he didn't want any of it. Left the house, the cars, and the dogs to the model, and turned up here with a rucksack and Ken's address on a piece of paper. Ken had given him the camper van to sleep in. In return, he was doing the place up, building walls, fixing leaks, all the stuff that Rory associated with real men. He tapped on the door of the camper van and took a step back. Owen appeared at the door a moment later. 6'1", topless, tanned to mahogany, his body as solid as a plank, chiselled and intimidating. He scratched his shaved head, yawned widely, revealing huge teeth full of fillings, and said,
"What?"
"Yeah," said Rory, putting on the weird Mockney accent he was painfully aware of using whenever he was with Owen, but seemingly incapable of stopping.
"You just woken up?"
Owen yawned again.
"Yeah. What time is it?"
"About 1. "Fuck," said Owen.
"Christ."
He scratched his head again and said,
"Fancy a smoke?"
Rory nodded and climbed into the van. The van was a shithole. It smelled of dusty upholstery and rotting foam, old smokes and Owen's trainers. He and Kaylee had spent their first couple of weeks on Ken's farm in the van. Then they'd moved into the caravan. Since the baby, they'd been upgraded to the lodge, which was the next best after Ken's house. And the only real benefit, as far as Rory was concerned, to having had a baby.
"Bad night?"
asked Owen, eyeing Rory as he licked two Rizzlers together.
"Meh," replied Rory. "Baby was awake every 2 hours."
Owen slanted his eyes and whistled. The baby's name was Tia. Rory had had no say in naming it, very much in the same way as he'd had no say in whether or not they were going to have a baby. This time last year they'd been in the UK, ostensibly to see his family, but in reality to have an abortion. Until Kaylee had decided, at the very last minute, literally 24 hours before their return flight, that she did not want an abortion. And they had to fly all the way back again, with the baby growing ever more viable within her body.
Rory was 24 when the baby was born. He'd felt as if he was going mad. How the hell had he ended up with a baby at 24? The baby had some problems. Reflux, colic, and glue ear. Small problems in the scheme of things, but problems that made her cry. A lot. Problems that took them to the doctor in town more than was desirable. Problems that required the administering of antibiotics and medicines. Problems that made it even harder than it might have been for Rory to feel as though this baby was something he wanted in his life. He could tell that the others resented it too. They resented the piercing screams emanating from the lodge 7, 8 times a night. They resented the constant background noise of griping and wailing, and the stress that went with it. Ken's farm was a place people came to live quietly, gently, selfishly. Rory and Kaylee no longer really fulfilled the brief. They snapped and they snarled. They threw barbed comments at each other and created atmospheres. And their baby screamed and screamed, her desperate cries blocking out the preferred soundtrack of humming cicadas, the amateur guitar strumming, the earnest chats about life and its many meanings. They were the ultimate party poopers, pissing on the whole beautiful, blissed-out, hedonistic parade.
"Here," said Owen, pulling open a small fridge and passing Rory a freezing can of San Miguel.
"Cheers."
Rory stared at the small can in his hand. He rolled it back and forth a couple of times between his fingers, enjoying the surprise, and then the numbness of it.
"It's Easter Day," he said.
"Oh, yeah," said Owen.
"Are you into that kind of thing, then?"
Rory shook his head.
"Nah, not really. Wasn't brought up into any kind of religion. But we all celebrated Easter. It was my mum's favourite day."
"Was," said Owen. "She dead, then?"
Rory laughed. "No, she's definitely not dead. Just..." He pulled the tab off the beer and sucked up the froth that burst out of the opening.
"I had a twin brother.
He killed himself.
On Easter Day."
Owen winced.
"Shit."
"How old was he?"
16. Just turned.
"He hung himself."
"Yeah."
Rory wasn't angry anymore. He'd stopped being angry at some indefinable point during the last few years, since he'd been in Spain. He was just sad now. Sad that he'd never know what Rhys was doing, or where Rhys was living, or who Rhys was going out with, or why Rhys had killed himself. Sad that Rhys would never meet his baby or his girlfriend. Sad that he didn't have a brother. Sad that he'd been angry instead of being sad. Sad that he couldn't say he was sorry for being such a crap brother.
"Shit," said Owen again.
"What'd he do that for?"
Rory shrugged. "No idea," he said. "Didn't leave a note. Never said anything to anyone." He let his shoulders drop. "So that's just, you know, Easter fucked, really."
"Yeah," said Owen. "I can see that.
That's tough. Really tough."
"How's your mum about it?"
Rory smiled.
"My mum," he began, unsure where he was going to take this. "Ah," he said.
"My mum is unusual. She has her own way of dealing with things, you know. She's not like other people, so basically she dealt with it by dumping my dad for the next door neighbour."
Owen raised an eyebrow at him and poked the roach into the end of the spliff.
"Who is a woman?"
"No way."
"Yeah. Late flowering lesbians. That's what she says they are." "Were you late flowering lesbians? Like they're trees or something."
"What, and they live together?"
"Yeah, in my family home.
With the woman's children?"
"And my sister. My dad lives next door."
"What, where the woman used to live?"
Rory laughed.
"No, they sold that.
Our house used to be two separate cottages, so they just put a wall back in and opened up the front door and moved all his stuff across. And now he's the next-door neighbour.
Owen chuckled.
I love other people's families, he said. They always make me feel better about me own.
He lit the spliff and inhaled.
So what about your sister? How old's she?
Rory squinted.
What, Beth? She's nearly 3 years older than me. And I've got another sister too, Meg. She's nearly 5 years older than me. She lives in London, has about 100 kids. And you used to have a brother?
Yeah. He smiled sadly.
I used to have a brother.
Tragic.
Yeah.
Owen passed him the spliff.
Cheers.
They sat in genial silence for a moment or two. Rory took in the details of Owen's van, the FHM calendar, the pristine polo shirts hanging neatly, the bottle of Kouros aftershave, the designer trainers in a row, the gold bracelet left pooled on the table, and he said,
What about you? What are you doing here? Just woke up one morning and had had enough of the whole lot of it. Got talking to a bloke in the pub who was going to a festival in a field somewhere. Thought, I like the sound of it. Got talking to this other bloke, singer in a band, said his dad lived out in a commune in Spain. That was that.
Rory shook his head. He already knew all of that.
But really? Why are you really here? What do you want?
Owen laughed.
I haven't got a fucking clue, he said.
Rory laughed too. And then he stopped when he heard the familiar sound of Tia screaming across the courtyard.
Poor mite, said Owen.
Rory nodded. It was hard to feel sympathy sometimes.
What about you? Said Owen. What do you want?
Rory smiled, and then he dropped his chin into his chest. He looked up at Owen and he sighed.
I think, he said, voicing a deeply buried thought for the first time, I think I want the next thing. I think, he paused, I want to move on.
Owen nodded sagely and took the spliff back from Rory. Outside the caravan, his baby screamed. Chapter 7 Saturday, 1st of January, 2011. Dear Jim, Happy New Year! And what a joy it is to have someone special to send that message out to. Oh, yes, I know I have three children, but... And I am struggling to find a way to put this that will not make me sound like an utter weirdo. We are, to all intents and purposes, estranged. Oh, I am shuddering at having written the word. And it is a testament to how close I already feel to you that I am able to do so. Yes, I have not seen one of my three children since the day of my partner's funeral, and that was over 4 years ago. I speak to my eldest girl on the phone, although we do just tend to come to loggerheads every time, which is rather tiresome, so it's best we try not to. I email my boy when I can, although his life is rather chaotic, and that is putting it mildly. I will regale you with some terrible tales of Rory when/if I feel able. It's all very lurid and probably does not reflect very well on me as a mother. Beth, my middle girl, well, for reasons I can't quite stomach going into here, we no longer have any contact. I don't even know where she lives. Isn't that awful? My baby. I made her in my body, fed her from my body, lived with her until she was, well, far too old to be living with her mummy, let's put it that way. We were so close. And now I don't even know if she's dead or alive. Oh, Jim, it's all just tragedy upon tragedy. I really am a walking tabloid. And writing these emails to you... It's making me think about things in a way I haven't thought about things for a long time.
About my life. About me. About my role and the way things have turned out. With Rhys. Gosh, yes, especially with Rhys. There's a metaphorical can of metaphorical worms just sitting there waiting to be prized open and gawped at. Not yet, though. No, not yet. Megan, my eldest, she keeps telling me I should see a therapist. Keeps telling me I've repressed a lot of things and that's why I am the way I am. And I just say, pa! Because that's what I always say to Megan. She's such an old bossy boots. But here I am, pouring it out to you, a virtual stranger. I hope you don't mind. Tell me to shut up if you do. Anyway, I am thrilled to hear that Josie's leg has healed. You must be so relieved. Thank God for pet insurance, eh? I hope you had fun last night at the pub and your head's not too sore this morning. I went to bed at just past midnight. Heard the bells ringing. Heard the old lang synes. Thought of you. Thought of my children. Thought of lost ones. And had a little cry. Only a little one. Nothing to worry about. Do you worry about me? I hope not. Bonne année, my dearest Jim. All love, L. Kiss, 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 kiss. April 2011. Molly dashed out of the hotel's ensuite bathroom, clutching a bottle of scent.
Look! She squealed. Actual perfume? Jo Malone, can I have it, please, Mum?
She clutched it to her chest and smiled winningly at Meg. Meg glanced at the room menu and said, It's £39.
No way. You don't even wear perfume.
Yes, well, I would if it was Jo Malone.
It's £39 and you're 15. Put it back. Molly let her shoulders slump melodramatically and shuffled back into the bathroom.
You're mean,
she said over her shoulder. But it was meant affectionately. A year ago, the Jo Malone exchange would have escalated into a bloody battle with swear words and pronouncements of maternal hatred and, more than likely, the scent bottle being hurled against a wall and a door being slammed hard enough to dismember a hand. This time, it ended with the soft chink of the bottle being gently replaced on the marble-topped counter in the bathroom, and Molly padding barefoot back into the bedroom.
Look,
said Meg, waving a small card at Molly. A pillow menu. Molly took it from her hand and smiled at it. Like the towel menus you invented when you were small.
Yeah, said Molly dreamily, stretching out backwards onto her bed and holding the card above her face. Way ahead of my time, clearly.
But no live palm trees.
I'll make a note of that on the comments form before we leave.
Meg smiled and lay back on her own bed. Quality time with her daughter. She'd never thought it would happen. She'd given up hope of ever having a nice time with her daughter again. And it had taken the death of her own mother to bring it about. Her phone rang and she sighed. Hello?
Good afternoon. Is this Meg Liddington?
Not Beth. Meg breathed a sigh of relief. Speaking.
Hello, this is Stella Richards from the coroner's office.
Oh, hello, yes, hi.
We've had the final results through. The cause of death for your mother, Lorelei Bird. Would you be able to come to our office? Possibly this afternoon, so that we can talk you through them.
Meg glanced at the time on the TV display in front of her. 2:35. We're in Mickleton. How far is that from you?
Oh, not far. About 40 minutes on the fast roads.
Fine, then. Yes, fine. But I'll have my teenage daughter with me. I mean, will it be okay? Is it, you know, suitable? I mean. The woman on the other end of the line paused for a moment.
Yes, she said eventually. Yes, I'm sure it'll be fine. So we'll see you in an hour,
said Meg, smiling reassuringly at Molly.
We'll see you in an hour.
April 2003.
Vic! Oh, Jesus, Vic!
Vicky dropped the pile of post she'd just picked up from the front doormat and turned towards the stairs.
What, love? Come quick, come!
Vicky took the stairs a pair at a time, quite an effort given her, frankly, dire levels of fitness.
What is it, love? What?
She followed the sound of Laurie's plaintive moaning into Meg's old room, the so-called office. Laurie stood on the small patch of carpet still uncluttered by shopping bags and piles of newspapers. She was crying.
"Someone's been in here," she said. "Someone's been moving my things around."
Vicky breathed in hard against a swell of irritation. "Oh, darling," she said. "Have they?"
"Yes. I had a new book. I only got it last week, and it was almost as good as new. I don't think it had even been read. And I came in here to find it, and the whole pile's gone, Vic. All of it."
Her hands were threaded through her hair, pulling at it by the roots.
"What book, love?" "I don't know. I don't know what it was called. It had a lovely cover, all purple and blue with a rose. But there were more. Books I haven't read. And they've all gone."
"Oh, darling, I'm sure they haven't. They're probably just not where you thought they were."
"No,"
Lorelei snapped.
"I know where everything is, everything. And I know I put it here."
She pointed at an area of grubby, unvacuumed carpet.
"Right here. And someone has moved it."
Vicky put her hand upon Lorelei's shoulder and squeezed it. "Darling, take a deep breath. Calm down."
"I cannot calm down, Vic. How can I? That book was precious. You know, precious."
Vicky repressed the urge to shake Lorelei very hard and scream, "No, it was not precious. It was some shitty old paperback that you can't even remember the name of."
"We'll need to talk to the girls about this,"
said Lorelei, pulling her hands from her hair and punching them together rather aggressively. Vicky did not appreciate the flavour of the gesture. It looked unseemly in the context of a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. "Why do we need to talk to the girls?"
"Because it must be them. Mucking about in here. They're always mucking about with my things."
Vicky breathed in hard again.
"Darling," she began, "I do understand your feelings. I appreciate how stressful you find it when your things get touched, but you have to bear in mind that there is very little space in this house for the girls to use. That it is almost, darling, inevitable that they will come into contact with your things, when there are so very many of your things for them to come into contact with."
Lorelei let her shoulders slump and tutted.
"It's just," she began melodramatically, "a matter of respect. Respect for other people's things. It's one thing to touch. But where are they, Vic? Where are my books?" "Well, if you must know, it was me."
She felt her heart quicken with nerves. Lorelei looked at her, aghast.
"There was a second-hand book sale at South School, at the Easter Fair. A fundraiser, darling, for their school. And you know how underfunded that lovely little school is. And I just thought, my God, Laurie has a lot of books she's never read and never will, and it's for such a good cause, without asking."
Lorelei's voice was brimming with hurt feelings. Vicky sighed.
"Had I asked, Laurie, what would you have said?"
Laurie tutted again and folded her arms.
"That's not the point."
"Well then, love, what is, exactly?"
"It's about respect. It's about privacy. It's about..."
Her face grew dark and tragic.
"I don't know what it's about. But you and your girls, you need to..."
"What, darling?"
"You need to butt out. Just butt out. Okay?"
"Oh, Laurie. Really and truly, I wouldn't say things like that."
"Why not?"
"Because one day, you might just get what you want. And I truly believe you wouldn't really want it." She smiled sadly at her love and walked away. Mummy? Maddie threw her mother a sideways look. Yes, darling? Vicky brushed Maddie's hair off her face, and Maddie pushed her hand away, as she always did. It did not stop Vicky from brushing Maddie's hair from her face. She was still allowed to do that, she was sure she was.
I need to tell you something. Something really important.
Vicky nodded.
No, but I mean, like, really important.
She sighed and stared dramatically through the car window. She had the loveliest profile, her older girl. So delicate and elfin. Go on, she said encouragingly, waiting for some tame, prepubescent revelation about a boy or a failed test. Maddie turned to her then abruptly and said,
I want to move out. I want to go and live with Daddy.
Vicky felt her stomach propel itself up towards her heart, and she hit the left indicator and the brakes, taking the car off the road and into a lay-by. She turned off the engine, and the silence as the radio stopped talking at them was sudden and overwhelming. Vicky turned 90 degrees in her seat and looked at Maddie.
But baby girl, she said, you can't move out. You're only 12. It doesn't matter how old I am. I'm not happy and I want to move out, and I've told Daddy and he says I can live with him. If you say it's okay. But darling, I don't understand. I mean, what exactly? It's Laurie.
Maddie's mouth was set hard.
I hate her and I don't want to live with her anymore.
Vicky reeled slightly at these words. She felt as if she'd been kicked in the chest.
What? I used to really like her, and she used to be really fun, but now all she does is moan about everything I do, and she tuts all the time, and she won't let me touch anything or go anywhere, and she keeps buying all this rubbishy old stuff, and some of it smells, and I don't want to share a bedroom with Sophie anymore, and I asked her if I could have Reese's old room, and she swore at me.
Maddie swallowed these last few words whole, gobbled them up so fast that Vicky was not entirely sure she'd heard right.
She did what? She swore at me. She called me a little shit.
Jesus Christ. Vicky breathed in hard.
When was this, darling?
Last week, when you were collecting Sophie from Emma's house.
But I don't understand what happened. Tell me exactly what happened.
Maddie sighed, as if she'd had to tell this story 100 times over.
Well, she was just coming out of her room, and I was just coming out of my room, and she said something about how lovely that me and Sophie shared a room, how she'd shared a room with her sister when she was my age, and how lovely it had been, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, well, I'm getting quite bored of sharing with her now, and it was like, you know, I've been thinking about saying something about Reese's room for ages now, and I've been going to say something to you, but then, like, she was just there, and so I said it, and she went all weird and said I was a thoughtless little shit.
She shrugged.
Oh, my God.
Vicky clutched her mouth with her hand.
But why are you only telling me this now? Why didn't you tell me before? I don't know. I suppose I've just been thinking about it. I mean, no one's ever sworn at me before. I wasn't sure how I felt about it. And then we were at Dad's this weekend, and I found myself telling him, and when I was telling him about it, it all kind of started coming out, the way I feel about Laurie. And I realised that I don't like her. I don't like living with her. I don't like all her mess and her stupid, precious things. And the way she looks at me is if I'm part of some weird dream she's having, and she isn't sure what to make of me. And how I can never invite friends back to my house because it's, like, so embarrassing. And everyone's starting to think I'm weird. It just all came out. And Dad said I could go and live with him. Now that I'm old enough to walk home from school. I could. I could do it. And then do every other weekend with you and Soph.
Oh, Maddie. Vicky fought back a sob.
I don't know what to say. I really don't. Just say yes. But I love you. You're my baby. I couldn't bear it if I didn't see you every day.
Maddie shrugged again.
I'd be lost, Maddie. Utterly lost without you.